from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've read a lot of wonderful books this year for this show. Novels, biographies, books of politics and philosophy, adventure and discovery. It's been a good year. So let's review and maybe discover still more gems. We've got three fine readers with us this hour to talk through, celebrate the year's best books, great reads. This hour, On Point, Best Books of 2013. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What was your favorite new book this year? What would make your top 10? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got three wonderful plugged-in readers with us today. They've each given us a top 10 list for 2013, and you can see those at our website, onpointradio.org. With us from New York is Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review. He's worked as an editor at the great publishing house for R. Strauss and Giroux. Lauren Stein, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi there. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you. From Berkeley, California, Eden Lapucki joins us. Eden writes for The Millions, an online magazine covering books and culture. She's author herself of the novel California, due out next summer. Eden, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And from beautiful Oxford, Mississippi, home of Ole Miss and William Faulkner, and for a long time John Grisham, Richard Howorth joins us, owner of the wonderful independent bookstore Square Books, right there on the Oxford Square, named Bookstore of the Year this year by Publishers Weekly. Richard Howorth, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be back.
So, Richard, let me just start with you. Overall, I mean, we'll look at I've got your list in front of us, and you've got Men We Reaped in the Tilted World and Collision, Low Crossers. Eden's got The Interestings and American Dream Machine and The Goldfinch and more. Lauren has Pitch Dark and All That Is and Dark Lies the Island and Traveling Sprinkler. But overall, Richard, you're watching people come in and browse and buy and no doubt talk about this year's crop. What's your assessment overall?
Well, it's been a great year for books, and we've had a terrific year of sales, and this fourth quarter has been especially good. We've had lots of strong local and regional books. That always helps us, and terrific books just across the board in all categories.
Eden, what's your sense of the year overall, and where things were strong?
Oh, I think it's been pretty much a delicious year for books. I mean, every time I go in The Millions, there's a new essay or review of a book I want to read. And then I go to the bookstore and my back hurts by the time I'm done from all the books that I've picked up. And Alice Munro won the Nobel, so that was exciting too.
Yeah. And Lauren, there in New York, I mean, you've been in the biz. Now you're publishing and thinking and talking about it. There are years when people are sort of holding their hands and saying, oh, what will win the National Book Award? What's worthy? This year doesn't seem to be one of those, Lauren.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I have the luxury, since I'm not a book publisher anymore, I can read lots of old books. And in a funny way, that makes it fun because I get to compare the new with the old. And the new ones are great. It was really hard finding 10 favorites. I bet the others had the same experience.
I'm sure they did. I mean, and the list go right on down. I mean, on yours, the Woman Upstairs and the Flamethrowers. The fun parts, we'll hear about some of that. Flora, Respect Yourself, What Not on Richard's list. Cartwheel, A Questionable Shape. White Girls by Hilton Owls on Eden's. I don't know, Richard, top of your list is Men We Reaped by Jesmyn Ward. That's Jesmyn. It's kind of a memoir. Tell us about your number one, Richard.
Well, Jesmyn Ward won the National Book Award in 2011 for her novel, Salvage the Bones. And this is a memoir that deals with much of the same material that appeared in that novel, but in a much more serious way. The book is set in her community of DeLille on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and she deals with the loss of life of five people she knew. She was either friend or related to, including one of her brothers, by accident, suicide, drug addiction, family breakup. And she examines with quite an honest eye the underlying conditions of poverty and racism that are so difficult to overcome. She writes with such power and grace and really kind of a calm control over a highly emotional subject. It's a very serious book, but marvelous writing.
Would you read just a little bit from The Men We Reaped by Jesmyn Ward to give us a sense?
Yes, this is toward the end of the book. She says, "We who still live do what we must. Life is a hurricane, and we board up to save what we can and bow low to the earth to crouch in that small space above the dirt where the wind will not reach. We honor anniversaries of deaths by cleaning graves and sitting next to them before fires, sharing food with those who will not eat again. We raise children and tell them other things about who they can be and what they are worth. To us, everything. We love each other fiercely while we live, and after we die, we survive. We are savages."
From The Men We Reap by Jesmyn Ward. Lauren, you've got, I mean, maybe in a similar vein, you've got George Packer's The Unwinding on your list. Richard looks to this book in a personal but serious story about young men snuffed out, burned out too soon in a tough country, our country. George Packer takes a kind of John Dos Passos look at that in his Unwinding, Lauren.
That's right. John Dos Passos is a great comparison. This is a book that purports to be, I think, is a secret history of the time we're living in, and the way Packer tells us what's been going on in the last 30 years is by looking at a bunch of individual stories. Another comparison, I think, would be The Wire, because just the same way that that series tells a story about Baltimore today or in the recent past, this book and some critics complain that it doesn't have an overarching theory that explains what the housing crisis has to do with money and politics, what that has to do with changes in the family. But that, to me, was its great strength. It confirmed our sense that the country we're living in has subtly, in ways that are hard to pinpoint from day to day, changed in ways that would have been hard for us to imagine 30 years ago.
Tell us about your top pick, and I know it's hard even to go to 10, let alone 1, but you've got Renata Adler's Pitch Dark right at the top of your list for us, Lauren. Thank you for doing that hard work, but tell us about the book.
Well, I bent the rules a little bit because it was published this year, but not for the first time. This is a book that first came out 30 years ago, and from Renata Adler, who has had a long career and is best known, I think, as a journalist and a critic, but in the 70s and in the 80s, she wrote two novels, and this is the less famous of the two. They're both cult classics, and the New York Review Classics, which does this wonderful work of hunting down books that often you've never heard of and bringing them back into print, has just reissued Pitch Dark. It's a novel about a woman getting over a breakup after an 8-year affair, and in the process of trying to get over this she goes on a solitary vacation in Ireland, and everything falls apart. It's the vacation from hell.
It makes it into 2013 in a reissue, but hey, sometimes old is new again. Could you read a little bit from Pitch Dark by Renata Adler for us?
We all find we cannot take on any more patients. We are all waiting for calls from superiors. Pick up the phones each time, hoping it is one of them, then find it is only another patient. The superiors, of course, think of us as patients and dread our calls. Is it always the same story, then? Somebody loves and somebody doesn't, or loves less, or loves someone else, or someone is a good soul and someone a villain. And there are just these episodes, anecdotes, places, pauses, hailings of cabs, overcomings of obstacles or instances of being overcome by them, illnesses, accidents, recoveries, wars, desires, welcomings, rebuffs, baskings, rare, not so long, pinings, more frequent, perhaps, and longer, actions, failures to act, hesitations, proliferations, endings of the line, until there is death? Well, no. I have a wonderful, fond memory about love and trust and books.
What a baskings and pinings from Pitch Dark by Renata Adler. That's just terrific. Thanks for that read. And Eden, your top is The Interestings from Meg Wolitzer. Tell us about it.
The Interestings is about a group of friends who meet in the 1970s at an arts camp, and they name themselves at that camp the Interestings. They have no humility in their
These are
early
teenagers,
teens.
I think.
Teenagers, yeah. Yes. They believe that they are destined for greatness, all of them, and nothing will get in their way.
Right.
And it follows them through their lives into the present day, so it spans quite a big chunk of time. And it's about, you know, how talent develops or withers. It's about jealousy between friends. It's a great book about money. It's about loyalty. And, you know, like all books that cover a lot of time, it's kind of about the comfort of time passing and also just the cruelty of time passing. And it's really a beautiful and very funny novel as well.
How does money come in? This is sort of boomers in their youth in the 70s aspiring or dreaming. And money how?
Well, some of the characters are quite successful. One is basically a genius, and he becomes a kind of like the Simpsons creator, Matt Groening. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Mm-hmm. His name is Ethan Figman in the book, and he creates this whole world, and he makes a lot of money. And then other characters, you know, not so much. They try to – one, the main character, arguably, Jules Jacobson, she tries to become an actress, and that doesn't work out. And she has a good life, but not quite as fabulous as her friends, and that's one of the issues in the book.
So it follows them over time, out of the 70s forward.
Yes, yes, into the present.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the best books, great reads of 2013, with Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review. Eden Lapucky from The Millions joins us from Berkeley, California. Richard Haworth is here from Oxford, Mississippi, owner of Square Books there on the lovely square in Oxford. And we've got a lot of response online. Palmer says, Chris Hadfield's in An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. I don't know. April likes yours, Eden, The Interestings. Mike says, Detroit, An American Autopsy by Charlie LaDuff. We talked with Charlie about that. Boy, he's a storyteller. Jonathan says, Jennifer Bradley's Metropolitan Revolution, Ira Katznelson's Fear Itself, and on they go. We'll hear from them straight in just a moment here. Eden, can you read from The Interestings for us?
Sure.
Set it up.
Yeah. All you need to know is that the characters are at a dinner party in the early 80s, and they are in their early 20s.
Okay.
The dinner party at which Dennis appeared took place on one of those evenings that came in a spasm in the early 80s, when everyone was first learning to cook and dinners featured elaborate food within limited parameters, since they all owned the same two approachable cookbooks. Chicken Marbella was ubiquitous, prunes, those unloved things, beetle-backed and shiny, with guts like meat, finally found their context. Cilantro was briefly everywhere, creating mini flurries of conversation about whether you did or did not like cilantro, which invariably included someone in the room saying, "I can't stand cilantro, it tastes like soap." That night, candles released tongues of red wax onto Isadora's tablecloth and windowsill, where it would leave an eternal crust, but it was no matter. Isadora's crappy furnishings, and even the apartment itself, would be abandoned when all the life practicing had exhausted itself and new desires replaced old ones. They all hated Ronald Reagan with a uniform loathing, and it astonished Jules Jacobson that other people in America, a majority apparently, actually liked him. Nixon had been an outright grotesque, and as far as she could see, Reagan was one too, with his oiled hair and padded shoulders like some dunder-headed uncle.
That's right. Megan, Meg Walitzer's The Interestings, Eden Lapucky reading there. It's funny, Eden, I mean, she just nails a certain moment there. I don't know how old you are, but Lauren Stein, I think you were at that dinner party with the Silver Palette cookbook and the prunes and chicken Marbella.
I was a child. I resent that.
Oh, right. Right. A mere child. Short pants. Oh, it sounds true to me. That's just great. And they roll on right into adulthood. Richard Haworth, take us to more. We've got The Men We Reaped here, The Tilted World by Tom Franklin and Beth Ann. Is it Fennelly? What have you got there, Richard?
Yes. She is a poet. He's a novelist. And they're married, and they wrote this novel together. I don't know how the marriage survived, but the book came out awfully well. It's set during the Great Flood of 1927 in the Mississippi Delta.
This is the one where the levee breaks, and then everyone sang about it forever. Is that the flood?
Pretty much. Yeah. The great book Rising Tide by John Barry was written about the same subject, a nonfiction book, a great book. But there's a federal agent, a revenuer who's gone missing in that area, and so two federal agents, G-men, are sent down to investigate. Shortly after arriving, one of the men finds an abandoned baby, and then soon meets a young woman who might make this child a good mother, he thinks, without realizing that the woman is running a moonshine still and is married to one of the most dangerous men in the territory. The rain keeps falling, and before long, all hell breaks loose. It's just a great story in the midst of a historic event.
Richard, how do you pick top books? Do you pick it by the reaction you see from readers in Square Books in your store? Do you pick it by personal predilection, or how?
Personal, from customers, from other booksellers who work in the store, from other booksellers in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. Everywhere we can get it. What I'm always listening for is the tone of genuine enthusiasm, and that's proved to be fairly reliable
in the voice of the readers who report back to you.
Yes, correct.
That's pretty darn good. I mean, you can't really fake that, and why would you? It's a book. You can be enthusiastic or not. Lauren, All That Is by James Salter, high on your list. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a novel by, James Salter has been writing for a long time. He's in his mid-80s, and his new novel he's been working on for years. It's about an editor named Philip Bowman, a World War II veteran. We first see him in combat, and then we follow him up into the 80s, the 1980s. And it's not about his work. It's not about his intellectual life. It's about his erotic life, his love life. And it's about falling in love, something he does many times over the course of over the years as he gets older and doesn't get much wiser. And that's something that some critics don't like about the book, but that I loved. It was on your list too, right, Richard?
Yes. I thought it was just great. He's able to expose the flaws of love in contrast to the desire for love, and he's just a terrific writer.
What is it about his handling of that, falling in love again and again and again, James, that makes it great? I mean, that's a story we know, but here this one takes you away. What is it about the way he takes us in there?
Well, there's a kind of glamour to Salter's writing. He's very good at conjuring up the glamour of sexual attraction, the way men and women seduce each other. He's very good at making you feel what a party is like. He's very good at surfaces. It's almost like an advertisement for sex. That's Salter's writing. And sex and vacations and luxury and, I mean, the luxury of living well. And it's very seductive.
But it's not 50 Shades of Grey from what I'm reading here.
I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey. It might be.
It was hard to avoid it a year or two ago. It was everywhere. Eden, take us on down. You've got American Dream Machine by Matthew Spector here. Fiction, tell us.
This is by Matthew Spector. It's published by Tin House Books, which also does a terrific literary journal. And I wrote about American Dream Machine for the Millions annual year-end reading series, where we ask writers and thinkers and readers to talk about their favorite books of the year. And I often don't write about a book that's been published this year, because I can write about any book ever in the history of time. But this book just really struck me. It's about, the rise and fall and rise and fall again of a Hollywood agent named Beau Rosenwald. Mm. And it's narrated by his illegitimate son, Nate. So it has a really interesting kind of first-person omniscient narrator,
if that's
possible.
And this is what, early 90s, kind of a grunge or slackerer time?
It covers quite a bit of time, not as much as The Interestings, but maybe I have a special thing for these kind of books. But it starts early, he arrives in Los Angeles in the early 60s and goes up into the present day. Mm-hmm. It has an interesting prologue that it starts in the 90s, and it has George Clooney has a really fun cameo in it. And it's sort of has a John Cheever Saul Bellow style to it. And I think it's just a great Hollywood novel, as well as a great novel about fathers and sons.
Will you give us just a clue about George Clooney's cameo?
Well, Nate isn't quite sure if it's George Clooney or just a guy who looks like George Clooney in his memory, because at the time George Clooney isn't famous, and they meet at Hamburger Hamlet on Sunset, which is no longer, and they get drunk together, I believe, and it's just one
Does
of a strange.
Clooney throw up?
I think he does into a ficus plant or something like
That's
that.
That's right. Of course.
Yeah. And it's one of those lost L.A. nights. I'm from Los Angeles, so maybe it's a soft spot for me. You know, it's 2 a.m. and you're in some random house in the hills looking down at the beautiful, strange city. And I think Spectre just captures that just perfectly.
Oh, that's terrific. That is American Dream Machine by Matthew Spector. Let's go to our listeners. Sarah is calling from Schroon Lake, New York. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What did you love?
Hi, the book The Goldfinch, and I was hoping they would talk about that a bit.
Yes, The Goldfinch, that's that's by Donna Tartt with
Donna
two
Tartt.
T's, if I've got that right. It's on your list, Eden. What about it, The Goldfinch?
Yes, I mean, unless you're under a rock, you probably have heard some murmur of The Goldfinch in the last few months. The author, Donna Tartt, she wrote The Secret History, which is a cult classic, and I am the president of this cult.
Okay.
And she doesn't publish a novel very often. This is her third novel in over 30 years, so every 10 or 11 years she publishes a book. And this is a big book. It's like 900 pages. The font's pretty small.
Wow.
But it's terrific.
Tell us about it. It's got this boy, Theo Decker, 13-year-old New York boy.
Yeah, his mother is killed in a bombing at an art museum, and Theo is effectively an orphan after that because his father is sort of a ne'er-do-well, deadbeat. He's just left the city. And at the bombing, Theo takes a famous Dutch painting called The Goldfinch, which is a real painting. And the story goes on from there and describes him over his, you know, again, I have a book on my list that has a lot of time passing, but we follow him as he tries to live with a very Tony family in Manhattan, and then his father comes to get him, and they go to live on the outskirts of Las Vegas in this strange kind of abandoned development. And through all of this, Theo has this painting secret hidden, and it has this sort of power over him. And it's a book about family, there's so much beautiful writing about grief in it and the sort of the power of art and how a person can look at a painting and feel a connection where they might not feel a connection anywhere else. It's really a stunning book.
The power of art, the underworld of art. Sarah, you called in with it. What did you like about it, Sarah?
Exactly how she described it.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that a piece of art could make someone risk everything in their life and just his relationships and the way she wrote it, the story aspect. And I thought it was sweet and great. I just loved it, but I'm not very good at articulating it. So
we hear it, and I appreciate your sharing that. That's The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Lauren, you've got The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner on your list, and that's another where the whole world of art, we're in the 1970s again here. There's plenty of motorcycles as well. But take us into The Flamethrowers, Lauren.
It's such a fun book. It's about a young woman named Reno who leaves California for New York. Leaves Nevada for New York, uh-huh. And shows up in Soho in the 70s and is hanging out on the art scene. She's also a very serious motorcyclist, and she gets involved with a guy who's part of an Italian motorcycle manufacturing family, and through that becomes involved in radical Italian politics in the 70s. And it's a story about young people on the make in New York and young revolutionaries in Italy. And it also has tendrils that go back to the past, to the fascists and the futurists. It's a really brainy, souped-up, just bristling with reading and with thoughts about contemporary art. It's not often that you see novels that deal seriously with contemporary art, with conceptual art, not just as material for satire, but as something that characters could care about and think about and talk about. So it's a lot of fun for lots of reasons.
Flamethrowers, Rachel Kushner. We're back in the 70s there again. I mean, it's funny. American Hustle just got all these Golden Globe Awards last night. We've had several books here already near the top of the list that take us back, and not least to the 70s. What do you think that's about, Lauren?
I don't know. It's something I think about a lot. I think there's something about the way we read novels now that makes us more open and curious about how novelists handle history than I think maybe we used to be. I mean, historical fiction has always been with us, but it's become sort of central to contemporary fiction.
Yeah, I love it. And why not? Richard, take us on down. Collision Low Crossers, Nicholas Davidoff. What have you got there?
Well, it's many reviewers are calling it the best book ever on about National League football, National football.
NFL, yeah.
NFL, yes. And Nicholas Davidoff is just a terrific writer. I think I've read all his books. He wrote that great book called The Catcher Was a Spy. He wrote a terrific book on country music. He wrote a book about, it was really a biography of his grandfather, who was an economics professor at Harvard and fled Eastern Europe in the early 20th century. But this book, he spends 15, 16 months, something like that, embedded with the New York Jets, and I think one of his main points is that, you know, we watch football on a Sunday afternoon, and we see this 60 minutes of what these people, these coaches, and these players do. And Davidoff takes us really deep behind the scenes into the personalities and lives of these men. And what it is that makes them tick, and how complex and difficult and grinding this whole profession is.
Well, everybody's been focused on that, and you can see the players focused on it in a way as well, as the NFL pushes them to hit differently, tackle differently. I've seen this one, Collision Low Crossers, described as part Paper Lion, part Moneyball, part Friday Night Lights, part The Office. What's The Office part? Is it funny, Richard?
He is an entertaining writer, and so when he finds there are funny moments that occur in the book, just as they do in life, and he brings those to life in a way that makes you, you know, feel like you're there.
I love it. Collision Low Crossers, nonfiction there, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football by Nicholas Davidoff. Eden, we've just got a minute before the break. If I'd Known You Were Coming by Kate Milliken, tell us just a little about it.
If I Known You Were Coming is a debut story collection. A great, great year for story collections this year. And it won the John Simmons Award from the University of Iowa. The prize chosen by Julie Oringer, who wrote How to Breathe Underwater, another great collection of stories. There's some reoccurring characters, so it has the drive of a novel. It's a very dark collection. They're sort of absent parents, despondent teenagers, just really lost characters. But the writing is quite sharp. It's often funny. And I picked it up when I was in Iowa City for a wedding, and I read it on the plane. I couldn't put it down. It just kind of swept me away.
Swept away by If I'd Known You Were Coming. Kate Milliken, is it her first collection of stories?
It's her first collection, which is part of why I wanted to highlight it here. I mean, these stories were so great, and it's a small press. I haven't seen that many people discussing it, and I really want them to, and I just can't wait to see what she comes up with next.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the best books, great reads of 2013 with Eden Lepucky of The Millions joining us from Berkeley, California. Lauren Stein, editor of The Paris Review, with us from New York. Richard Howorth is here. He's owner of Square Books, Bookstore of the Year, named by Publishers Weekly, right there on the square in beautiful Oxford, Mississippi. Kelly's calling from Spokane, Washington. Kelly, thanks for calling. What did you like?
Hi, Tom. I loved Michael Paganini's The Telling Room, The Tale of the Cheese, Love, Betrayal, and Revenge.
And The World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. Yes, we had him on, I think, in September. This is about the guy who was sort of floundering and lost in life and became obsessed with a maker of rare cheese in northwest Spain, as I recall, Kelly.
Yeah, you did a fantastic interview, Tom. It was just phenomenal. I went and bought the book that day, and it just really spoke to me. I mean, the book was written with a lot of love, and I think, you know, it was almost a bridge to a missing world, the life that the cheesemaker led, and the way that food, you know, is produced from the very organic roots, and just how much we're depriving ourselves and our future generations of just that huge loss is, it just spoke to me. It was such a beautiful book.
Yes, now I remember. And to be swept back to those, what is it? Every family had a kind of a cave dug into the walls there where they would keep their cheese and go off for long talks. It's so nice to be swept away. Like El Cid and all the rest was there. The Telling Room by Michael Paterniti. Yes, that was really fun, Kelly. I appreciate you reminding us. Let me get one more. Tamara is calling from Hampton, Virginia. Tamara, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What have you read?
Okay, I have read a book called Americana, and the author, she's an African woman. Her name is Chimamanda Adichie, and I heard her on your show. The book is excellent. It's about her coming from Africa, coming to America. She goes to Harvard. She doesn't talk so much about attending Harvard, but just as she goes through her daily life, things that she notices, she falls in love with an African guy and a white guy, but the story is really good. Her writing is very, very crisp, great adjective, and she makes you think. So it was my best favorite book this year.
Tamara, I love it. You know, that journey from Africa to America, even today, is a real cultural leap, and it must be the way she laid it out that grabbed you there.
Yes, and also another thing she does in the book, she compares African-American women who are born in America to African women, you know, in her day-to-day,
sure.
You know, going, and that's really interesting, which I was like, wow, I didn't know that.
That's a rich subject for anybody, and if you're an African-American woman, maybe particularly interesting to read, and you say she does it well, and we're glad to hear that. Thank you, Tamara, for that. Let me get one more. Vasanta in Springfield, Illinois. Vasanta, what's yours?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My book, I'm part of a book club called Charm Bracelet. We are this fantastic 8 women. And over 5 years, we've explored different cultures. The latest book that we read about probably 3 months ago was Dinner by Herman Cook.
Cook as in K-O-C-H?
Yes, K-O-C-H. And that's how in America we pronounce Cook. But
yeah,
you know,
tell us about it. What's it about? Dinner. Tell us about it.
It's about, you know, two brothers and their wives. They meet at this, you know, fancy restaurant, and then they start discussing banalities and everyday life and over each course and how each one's little quirks, you know, gets onto the other one. But slowly it reveals the darkness that, you know, behind. And it's a dark book, but the writing is beautiful, and it's about love, actually, in terms of how far we can go, seemingly normal, ordinary people, and to protect our loved ones if they have committed something not so nice or a crime,
yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, one of those books that I started, I didn't put it down till I finished. It's not a very big book, but the writing was fabulous. And it was just fantastic, and everybody in our book club loved it. And so I thought I will share that with you.
Vasanta, you convey that beautifully. You've got my attention. Dinner by Herman Koch, K-O-C-H, as in Koch Brothers in this company. Vasanta, thank you for that one. Lauren Stein, you've got a little reading from Sam Lipsitz, The Fun Parts. Tell us about that and set up a reading for us, if you would.
Well, I'll read the beginning of one of the short stories in this collection. Sam Lipsitz has published a few novels and a couple of story collections. This is the second one, and he's in his, I guess, his mid-40s. His characters, we've watched them grow up from being young men, mostly men and women from New Jersey and New York, and now they're having kids and dealing with that. This is a story. Well, I'll just read the beginning.
Okay.
So it doesn't need, it's called This Appointment Occurs in the Past. Mm. Davis called, told me he was dying. He said his case was, here was essence of Davis, time sensitive. Come visit, he said. Bid farewell to the ragged rider. You, I said, the cigarette hater? That's just wrongness. Nonetheless, brother, come. Who was that? Said Ondine, my ex-mother-in-law. I kissed her cream-golden shoulder, slid out of bed. A sick friend. I've known him 20 years, more, since college. I might have to leave town for a while. No, said Ondine, you're leaving town for good. The occupation ends today. It's been calamity for us, for the region. Go to your friend. He's not really my friend. All the more reason to go to him, said Ondine. Jesus would be in Pennsylvania by now.
What wonderful attitude in there, and no less than Ondine as the ex-mother-in-law. I mean, I think we hear...
Who he's in bed with.
Oh, great. Okay. The fun part's by Sam Lipside. I think we hear it, but you tell us, Lauren, what grabbed you in this collection of stories?
Well, humor is a quality that is generally mistrusted in written fiction, I think. We like it in TV, but we don't. We suspect it when we see it on the page. But at the Paris Review, we love it, especially in short stories. And both of the short story collections that are on my list, Sam Lipsight's and Kevin Barry's Dark Lies the Island, they're both distinguished by being very, very funny. And, I, you know, Sam Lipsight has this very taut, crisp, punchline-y, jokey, Stanley Elkin-y, Gordon Lishy prose.
Yes. That's quite a list in itself. Gordon Lish, my old teacher right there, and Jesus would be in Pennsylvania by now. What a great line. Richard, Flora by Gail Godwin. Tell us about it. It's a novel, fiction. What is it?
It's a novel that's set at the close of World War II, and the protagonist is a 10-year-old girl who lives with her grandmother and her father. Her father's called away to the other side of the mountain, Oak Ridge, to work on something called the Manhattan Project. Yeah. So she's left with her grandmother. Her grandmother dies, and a cousin, a 22-year-old cousin from Alabama, comes to live with the girl while the father is away. One day, a grocery delivery man, a discharged soldier, appears, and Helen, the 10-year-old girl, develops a relationship. She's a special friend of this man, this young man who's handsome, and then she soon realizes that her 22-year-old and quite beautiful cousin has an even more special relationship with him. So there's all kinds of tension, and it's just some of the comparisons have been to Henry James with its quiet, dark, and explosive psychological drama. And I just thought it was a really wonderful book. Gail Godwin's, I think, maybe 77 or 78, and she's a writer who's done good work for a long time.
It sounds terrific. Flora by Gail Godwin. I mean, I see many on your list, Richard, that are kind of regional, and I think I've heard you speak to, I mean, we hear so much about localism and locavores today, but as a bookseller, even in the book trade, that kind of regional flavor, maybe it's especially important these days. Speak to that, Richard.
I think it's just natural. You know, shop local, buy local, write local. I don't know whether it's just a common sensibility or knowing people or what, but I'm attracted to these books. But I'm also attracted by the other. I'm as Lauren said earlier, I'm jealous of his luxury to go back and read the old stuff. I'm always having to keep up with the new stuff, and many of my favorite writers are not from here,
sure,
from elsewhere, and so it doesn't necessarily work that way.
But when it does, you've got it all right there, and to sell it on the square in Oxford, all the better. Judith in Montgomery Center, Vermont. Judith, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would just like, this is not with regard to specific new books.
Okay.
But I would like you to just ask your listeners to consider books on CD for gift giving for those who might be disabled or have a very hard time reading. It's kind of in the old days we would sit and read to elderly folks or people who couldn't read, but I've recently had some tremendous successes and watching the enjoyment on the faces of people who can get the written word in a most wonderful way when it's recorded, often in the in the voice of the author. And I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah.
People don't often think of it. And I've had a couple of phenomenal readings aloud. David Gutterson, East of the Mountain, and several of Isabel Allende's novels.
Lover, yeah.
And just to mention that, so that people would be inspired, perhaps, to think of an elder relative or friend.
It's a great suggestion, Judith. It's just great. I mean, how better to be swept away, taken away, exercise the mind when maybe the body's not working as well as it once did. It's a great suggestion on any front. Get it on audio and give it on audio. Eden, take us on down. You've got one called Still Writing, The Pleasures and Perils of a Creative Life by Danny Shapiro. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Danny Shapiro has written quite a lot of novels and memoirs. So she's both a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer. This is not really a how-to writing book. It's more a thoughtful meditation on what it means to be a writer and what it takes to be a writer. It's kind of in the tradition of The Writing Life by Annie Dillard, which was one of my favorite books in the genre. And this is catnip for writers, for sure. I also would recommend it for anyone who has a passion, whether it's writing or painting or like bodybuilding or something, just something that you're devoted to. I think she has a lot of really smart stuff to say about what it means to, you know, discipline yourself and to wrestle with your work and yourself. And it's a really thoughtful book, I think.
Joy and satisfaction lie there if you're lucky. Could you read a little bit?
So the book is told in these little really satisfying vignettes, and they range from anything from just a random aside about, you know, something her poet friend said to a memoir passage about her upbringing. And this one is sort of a little bit more in the craft technique / meditation on writing.
Yeah.
It's called Beginning Again. We may be halfway through a novel, an essay, a story, or a memoir, or we may be nearing the finish line on a piece that has taken us years. But wherever we are in our work, we have never been exactly here today. Today, we need to relearn what it is that we do. We have to remind ourselves to be patient, gentle with our foibles, ruthless with our time, withstanding of our frustrations. We remember what it is that we need, the solitude of an empty home, a walk through the woods, a bath or half an hour with a good book, the echo of well-formed sentences in our ears, whatever it takes to begin again. When I was first learning to meditate, this idea of beginning again was revelatory. It still is. The meditation teacher Sharon Salzberg speaks of catching the mind scampering off like the little monkey that it is, into the past, the future, anywhere but here, and suggests that the real skill in meditation is simply noticing that the mind has wandered. So liberating, this idea that we can start over at any time, 1,000 times a day if need be. I see many parallels between the practices of meditation and writing, but none are more powerful than this. Writing is hard. We resist, we procrastinate, we veer off course. But we have this tool, this ability to begin again. Every sentence is new, every paragraph, every chapter, every book is a country we've never been to before. We're clearing brush. We don't know what's on the other side of that tree. We are visitors in a foreign land, and so we take a step, up the stairs after the morning coffee, back to the desk after the doorbell has rung, return to the manuscript. It never gets easier. It shouldn't get easier. Word after word, sentence after sentence, we build our writing lives. We hope not to repeat ourselves. We hope to evolve as interpreters and witnesses of the world around us. We feel our way through darkness, pause, consider, breathe in, breathe out, begin again, and again, and again.
Oh, wonderful. From Still Writing There by Danny Shapiro. That's just great. The mind, that little monkey scampering off.
Yeah.
maybe slowed down and focused by a good book. Lauren, White Girls by Hilton Owls. In your cluster of top faves, tell us about it.
Oh, it's a terrific book. Your listeners will probably know, if they read The New Yorker, they'll know the name Hilton Owls because he's their theater critic. That's what he usually writes about. This is a different side of Owls. It's although some of these pieces come out of stuff he wrote for The New Yorker, it's a book about, well, Richard Pryor and Truman Capote and Malcolm X, the usual list of white girls.
And plus Flannery O'Connor and Louise Brooks.
And Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah,
she's a white girl.
Wide definition. What's he mean?
Well, I'd rather let him say. I think your listener should pick it up. But I would say something like, we contain multitudes, and we especially when it comes to sex and race, we have images of what it means to be white and what it means to be a girl that are very powerful for us, even if we don't fit the category in a day-to-day obvious way. But Al's writes in a very associative, jazzy style. It's really something to check out.
You tempt us mightily right there. Wherever you start, if Truman Capote and Malcolm X and Flannery O'Connor all fit the bill, I'm in anyway, and ready to learn more. You are all three so generous to share with us the full top 10 list from each of my guests today up at our website, onpointradio.org. Plus, we will gather all of your listener suggestions right there, and many have come in off air as well. Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review, great of you to be with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you.
Eden Lepucky with The Millions in Berkeley, California. Eden, thank you.
Thank you.
And Richard Howarth at Oxford or Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you, Tom. Enjoyed it very much.
This is On Point.